corporate candy floss news and no political spin. This is Truth Radio by Internet. Thanks to our sponsor, Neemwell.com, because here, the expression is still free. It's Tuesday, the 25th of October, and if you're a Christian, maybe you need to listen to this sitting down. Was Jesus Christ a composite character, God and man, king and carpenter, conqueror and peacemaker, or was he a real individual? We'll be finding out with our guest, Ken Humphreys, who says Jesus never existed. You're on the next level.
Would you do me a favor and push me on to the next level?
And this is Fintan Dunn reporting. Thank you for joining us today. Thanks also to our sponsor, Neemwell, NEEMWELL.com. Check it out for yourself. Or email Kathy, Kathy, at Neemwell.com about an astonishing Indian herb that will do wonders for your health, as it did for mine. Now, you probably really do need to fasten your seatbelts today, especially if you are an ardent Christian, because our guest, Kenneth Humphreys, is maintaining quite boldly, quite flatly, that Jesus never existed. And you can get the whole story at JesusNeverExisted.com. Kenneth, in his time, has been a college lecturer in social sciences, a photographer and a computer salesman. But in recent years, he has turned his attention to a close study of the historical basis for the character we know as Jesus Christ. And he has compiled a compelling array of evidence to indicate that the Jesus Christ figure was actually a composite put together by early Christians from myth and legend of their times. His reassessment of the story of Jesus doesn't just question the veracity of Jesus, but also questions the so-called 12 disciples of Jesus, and he throws a lot of doubt also on the veracity of the Old Testament. Yeah, maybe you do need to sit down for this, because Kenneth Humphreys is joining us on the line now from the United Kingdom. You're very welcome, Kenneth, to the next level on breakfornews.com.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, and it's great to have you on, Ken. It's an astonishing website. Can I ask you, how did you get the idea? How did you get involved in this?
Okay, I mean, that's a good question, and it's one I often reflect on myself, having spent so much of recent years on this project. I've been a student of history, I guess, all my life. I've been an academic, I've taught social sciences, and I've always had an interest in religion, although I've never been religious. So unlike a lot of my correspondents, I am not an ex-believer who's somehow venting his fury or getting things off his chest. I'm simply, I'd like to think, a dispassionate writer of historical topics. Because of my interest in the organized church, I took a closer look at it. And the website really is the result of many years of study.
Right, well, you must have done that on an ad hoc basis as you were going along. And presumably, Ken, there came a moment when you said, I just got to start putting this out there.
You know, oh, yeah.
Was there a piece of evidence you found? Was there a moment when the evidence accumulated that led you to say...
There was a moment. It was my eureka moment, I think, if I put it that way. I was just reflecting, and you have to forgive me, but this is something I do. I was reflecting about the origins of the Dark Ages. I mean, one of my favorite subjects, areas of interest, was always the barbarian invasions of Europe and the collapse of civilization. And the eureka moment was when I was reflecting on the cause of the Dark Age and the role of the church, and I suddenly realized that the church was the cause of the Dark Age. Now, until then, of course, I'd gone along with the conventional wisdom that still served up, that the church kept the flame of civilization alive in remote monasteries in your part of the world.
Yes.
And that somehow eventually Europe recovered and the modern world began. However, I realized the church was instrumental in creating the Dark Age. And from that point on, I resolved that I really should write this down and write out an article or an extended article illustrating that point. And that was when it began.
But it may be confusing to people that we're even beginning to discuss this, because I tell you, Ken, lots of people out there are very familiar with the new book and all the theories about Holy Blood, Holy Grail, discussing whether or not Mary Magdalene was a disciple or was an actual wife of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
All of which would lead you to the assumption that, hey, we're dealing with a historical figure here and we're just arguing the fine details.
Mm.
How can we reconcile this belief or this arguing over Mary Magdalene when you're saying, hey, the guy himself didn't exist?
Well, it's a good point. I mean, I will not make a fortune from this website or from the book simply because it is not a novel. Now, if you allow yourself to drift off into the realms of fiction, then you can indeed write some enthralling tales about the marriage of Jesus, the offspring of Jesus, the mystery of the Holy Grail, or the Da Vinci Code, or whatever you wish, because the core of it all is just a few snippets of ambiguous history and an awful lot of fiction to make a good story. Now, I'm not a novelist. I'm not writing a made-up story. I'm trying to recall what we do know. And frankly, none of those, that whole genre of Jesus lore, which extends in so many different directions. He went to Japan, he was over at Glastonbury, wherever you want to take it. That Jesus lore basically is amusement, it's entertainment, but it has nothing to do with history.
Right, and yet there are people at this very moment who are tracing and tracking and attempting to determine if they are descendants or not, and who claim to be able to trace the bloodline of Jesus Christ.
Well, honestly, I do really break into a smile with that suggestion. I mean, they can amuse themselves no end, but let's remind ourselves, between the supposed existence of Jesus and today, there's an awful lot of centuries, and many of them really were very dark indeed. There's very little tangible evidence for genealogy or bloodlines, and frankly, it all gets lost somewhere in the late Middle Ages, an age that was fabulous for its fraudulent artifacts and relics. These people can write their bloodlines or trace whatever they like, but it is fiction, you know.
Right, okay. Well, I mean, it's a good point. You're saying that they have, if you like, filled in rather liberally some of the gaps in the chain of evidence along the years. Where those gaps are, they're putting favourable interpretations on what's
absolutely
in the gaps. Yeah. But so let's take some of the core issues that you raise, Ken. Astonishing issues. To me, encountering the material first, the most astounding stuff was realizing that if there was, in fact, a Jesus Christ alive at the time and had these extraordinary attributes to heal the sick, to rise from the dead, etc., he'd just have to get in line behind all the other superheroes, because these attributes were already in the mythos of the time from characters previous to Jesus.
Yes, I mean, there is obviously a core claim at the basis of Christianity that there was this individual, he was both man and God, and he really did exist in historical time. But history doesn't bear that out, to be honest. And you're right, there was a mythos of that age. It was a time in which the cultures were syncretic and fusing ideas from Persia, from further east, from India, from Egypt, from Greece, etc. These ideas were fusing. They formed various notions of God-men, and Jesus really fits into that model. What I would say, having extensively studied its development, it is like the final product of that time. Jesus is the God with everything. He takes over all previous gods' attributes and becomes the superhero.
Hercules, yeah. For example, and there was a shock to me to see an image on your website there of Hercules carrying his cross. I'm saying, hold on a second. The guy who carried the cross was Jesus, I thought. And yet here I'm looking at Hercules. That's an example of this crossbreeding between superheroes.
We are talking of a time when good ideas were borrowed and integrated into rival cults. So such things should not surprise us. One reason why both my website and the book are lavishly illustrated is because pictures make a very potent point which might be lost in just words. When you see these images, when you see the syncretic and synthesis of what's occurring at that time, then I think the point comes home.
Okay, so it's almost like in the modern era, rival brands, McDonald's and Burger King, robbing off each other and enhancing their religions with claims which mirror the claims of competing religions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And some of the earliest pagan critics of the Christians accused them of continuously revising their holy books in order to take on board some earlier criticism or omission pointed out that they were a work in progress and they were just writing in the necessary missing parts.
So was there a really fundamental disconnect, Ken? And was it, in fact, when the church intersected with Rome that this mythology was created?
Okay, what we've got to accept and understand is that the notion of this demigod, Jesus Christ figure, evolved over a considerable period of time. Didn't happen in one lifetime. It didn't happen as a result of a group of men getting round a table somewhere and saying, let's invent this guy, you know, it'll be a good money spinner. It was a protracted cultural development over two or three generations at least. It was a process by which the initial hopes and aspirations of a deliverer were steadily but surely given more substance and ultimately moved from being a guardian figure, a deity in heaven, into a human being who had lived on the earth at some distant time in the past. And once that story was told, it began to be retold and documented in some form or other, but added to and made more convincing the more that time passed. And one of the extraordinary but obvious things is the later the documentation about Jesus, the more detailed and colourful are the stories. Now, that really only has one explanation. You know, it wasn't that nobody bothered to note all these details at an earlier stage. These details were actually added to the story with the telling.
And in fact, some of the details seem to be like a coalition of something that was very popular in Rome, was the official empire religion, so to speak, Mithraism. That seemed to transform itself into the Jesus legend.
Yes, you know, if we look at that host culture of the Roman world as it existed in the 1st century BC, the 1st century AD, there was a need for an ideological, a religious cement to integrate many disparate peoples that had been drawn into the empire. They had their own local gods and deities, which Rome, being a very tolerant society in terms of religious belief, was happy to bring into the Roman pantheon, that Rome could integrate all these gods, and they merely identified a god from Gaul or a god from Asia with one of their own deities, had similar attributes, had similar purposes, and so there was this great tendency to composite gods into identifiable figures across the empire. Now, the Jews presented a particular problem for Rome because of their separatism and their aloofness from the empire. But ultimately, it was Christianity which gave a route for Jews also to join in the Roman world. Obviously, they resisted, there were revolts, but essentially with the emergence of Christianity, they were then able to move across and become the earliest Christians and become part of that empire. So we can see how the fusion is actually taking place, and drawing into itself elements from all the different parts of the region.
It's, I might echo a phrase that people would say about governments today if they were credulous. They say, oh, the government wouldn't lie to us. And you detail that these people were prepared to lie, that they regarded it as their religious duty to lie, to construct the myth.
Certainly as we move forward in time, this willingness to lie for what would be interpreted as a greater purpose was certainly present. I think before the Christians came to power, their fabrication of evidence was merely show business. This was how they were building up their clientele, and they were led by people who perhaps took advantage of the simpler spirits in these early groups to baffle them with a little bit of magic and fool them with outrageous stories, which in their innocence they believed. And so charlatanism was part and parcel of that sort of religious environment at the time. Now, of course, the big break for Christianity came when the Emperor Constantine backed a particular faction in his struggle to take over the Roman world. Mm-hmm. Now, once the hierarchs of the church were established as controlling elements of the Roman system, then, of course, they had an additional reason to lie in order to install their system across the Roman Empire and in order to propagate the official policy. And they were, if you like, the first to use a sort of state-sanctioned religious propaganda.
Right. So did the official approval, did that accelerate a process that was already underway, or were they already in the business of telling lies, of making up let's not put too harsh a construction of it. They were of their era.
We must, if you like, allow for the fact that the fidelity for an objective truth is very much a modern concept. It wasn't nearly so clear-cut in ancient times, but nonetheless, you could say they had an agenda. An agenda whereby they certainly from a very early stage believed they had a monopoly of truth, and that their God-man was, if you like, the only valid one, and therefore they should impose this upon everybody else. And of course, with the migration from what had been the pre-Constantine era of the Roman Empire, the exclusion of alternatives became ever more the imperative. You know, Constantine himself was not totally intolerant of alternatives. He simply favoured the Christians. But by the time we get to a later emperor, such as Theodosius, he is utterly intolerant of the alternatives. By that stage, any other religions and then the classic pagan religions are demonised, and they are not to be allowed. You know, to support them, it was heresy, was a rejection of the official system, and therefore it became a capital offence. So Christian history is obviously, you know, are fond of this notion that they won hearts and minds, but actually they used capital punishment as a means of compelling people into the church.
Right. Well, that's a really good way of ensuring orthodoxy. But were they already well along the way in terms of fabrication by the time it became a state religion, or did the state religion really open the floodgates in terms of fabrication?
Well, I would say the fabrication began from the very first. If we try and trace the development of the Gospels, of the New Testament, this is largely a work which was carried out in the 2nd century AD. We can see how at that stage they were adding elements from other sources. Mary becomes a virgin. You know, we can see the development of false ideas for a purpose, in order to bring people to the religion, to the truth. Now, you could say they felt these were justifiable fabrications in process. You know, it's probably no different, really, from being told there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You know, for a purpose, certain
right.
falsehoods are told.
Yes. Keep your seatbelt fastened, because we're only warming up. You're on The Next Level on breakfornews.com. Let's take a brief break from music, and we'll be right back.
plus à toi.
Well, you've detailed how the issue of Jesus of Nazareth falls apart on the issue of Nazareth itself, and whether there was one there at the time.
Yes, when I began this project, I would have gone along with the idea, well, there was probably a Jesus. You know, that's a, you can reach that conclusion very easily. You simply say, well, we have Christianity, there was probably a Jesus, and the matter ends there. But in actual fact, when you try and find the evidence, when you try and find what would really constitute convincing evidence for such a person, you find it vanishes before your eyes. It's rather like trying to find a rainbow from a distance, so you can see it in all its glorious colours, but then you try and find it, you can't get to it, you reach its origin and so on, it disappears. And this is a case with Nazareth. We're all quite happy to talk about Jesus of Nazareth. We know there's Nazareth now, and a million people a year, your tourists visit Nazareth. You know, it makes a wonderful living out of selling artifacts to the tourists. But, you know, when was there a Nazareth? Yes, it did exist in the Middle Ages. Yes, it did exist, you know, centuries before that. But the really crucial thing is, did it exist in the first century AD? Now, that's when it, you know, the trail ends. That's when, even though archaeologists have been looking for that evidence for, you know, 200 years, you know, they don't really find any evidence. It is very questionable whether there was any significant settlement at all on the site of Nazareth at the time that Jesus supposedly lived. Now, of course, apologists, you know, quickly jump in and say, well, of course, it was a small place. You know, forget the fact that the Gospels actually describe it as a city, right? It actually then becomes not a city, but a town, but not a town, a village, and then it's a tiny hamlet because there's actually nothing there. Now, okay, we may not have found it yet is one possibility, though frankly I think that's just clutching at straws. You know, we should have found it. The nearby cities, that, you know, like Sepphoris, we can find that all right. There's not a problem with that. So why can't we find Nazareth? And the answer is, well, it probably, almost certainly, was the creation of theology. In other words, the city followed the notion that there would be a Nazareth. The original Jesus was called a Nazarene. He wasn't of Nazareth. That's an English translation. It was Jesus the Nazarene. And now we might then track down and look at the reason for that particular word. But it had nothing much to do with a town called Nazareth.
And taking just some classic aspects of what we think we know of the life of Jesus, this idea of emerging in of other figures and other fables seems to happen in the case of the 12 disciples. That this 12 disciples, when you go and take a close look at it, you find that they are rooted in other figures in history.
Now, you would have thought that, well, we could find out, flesh out the story of the 12 disciples, but I would challenge anyone to do that. You know, what we have are church traditions about the 12 disciples. What the earliest texts say, what they mention is the figure 12, and we might then say, well, is there something special about 12? Well, there is something special about 12. It's a sacred number. We have the 12 tribes of Israel. We have the 12 signs of the zodiac.
Yes.
Mithras, when he crossed the sky, he passed through the 12 signs of the zodiac, which were his 12 followers. So isn't it surprising then that Jesus comes on the scene and he also has 12? And yet the 12, if most of the 12, are very shadowy characters. You know, most of the 12 we know nothing about. One or two of them are mentioned in one or two verses alone, and that's all we know about them. So here is an evidence that from 12 was then given 12 names, and of about four or five of them, there was a little bit of a biography added in subsequent to that. So here is an example of how the story grew with the telling. And after that, of course, throughout the Middle Ages, you have so-called traditions of all kinds of wonderful adventures that the 12 had. All their journeys to Africa and England and Persia and so on, and all their miraculous acts and then their various deaths and so on. And some of them, as I've tried to illustrate in one of my articles, is that some of them had deaths all over the show. You know, everyone was claiming them. Everyone had a different ending for their particular favoured disciple. The story is patently fraudulent.
Well, how did that play out in terms of the Gospels then? What's your interpretation of what we're looking at in the Gospels?
We have basically a story masquerading as history. I mean, to be fair, nobody actually claims that this is pure history. It's history with a purpose, so they would say. But the history within them is incidental. Yes, it does. They do mention historical characters. That is true. But then so does any historical novel. An historical novel will name real cities and possibly real people, and then weave a story around that. And that is really what we have in the Gospels. We have stories weaved around a few key events. It mentions the most famous of all the Jewish kings, Herod. It mentions the most notorious of Roman procurators, Pontius Pilate. It mentions a time before when they were written, a time lost before the wars, when nobody can really check anything, when this whole drama was played out. And, of course, the extraordinary thing is when this drama of Jesus' life was played out, nobody, but nobody, recorded anything. Not even the Gospels. Not even the Gospels were written at that time.
Yeah, and one of the things you bring out, which is a very good point, is that while, yes, the story of Jesus incorporates these historical events, historical figures, it doesn't go the other way. The historical records of the time, which are quite comprehensive, they don't mention Jesus.
No, and that is a cardinal point. You know, if anyone is under the impression Jesus is an historical character, then it's reasonable to ask, well, where is the evidence of that? Forget your Gospels for the moment. That is, if you like, prejudicial evidence. Where is there any other evidence? Now, at this point, Christian defenders, if you like, go into a sort of twilight zone of special pleading. None of the historians of that period recalled anything of their God-man. None of them. There's nothing in the Roman records. It's as if this person never existed anyway. Their first port of call is usually the Jewish historian Josephus. Now, Josephus is a very important source for information on the first century. Mm-hmm. He's a very important source for history of the Jews generally. Now, he is a source for us today. He was also a source for the Christians of the second century. It's fairly clear there are so many correlations between information in the works of Josephus and what appears in the Gospel and the New Testament. In other words, we can prove pretty closely that so much of the Gospels are actually extracted from and inspired by the works of Josephus. And the interesting thing is, his History of the Jewish War wasn't written until the 70s, and his Antiquity of the Jews wasn't written until the 90s. So on that basis alone, we can say anything written about in the Gospels came after that event.
Well, you know, even when I was saying there, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, it's been drummed into you so much from childhood that they almost have this sort of sacramental value in themselves. The words themselves have an almost sacramental aura because we're used to them from childhood. And we're used to the Old Testament story as well. And you're not just having a go at the historical Jesus, you're having a go at the whole notion of a Jewish empire and Kings David and Solomon and all the rest of that came before.
Well, okay, having a go, yes, we can put it that way. Certainly, I don't mince my words about this.
Well, I'm using the term lightly, so I mean, having a go in the most favourable, charitable way. You're not taking it on face value. You're saying, hold on a second here with this Jewish empire stuff.
If we take the patriarchs of the Jews, and after all, this is a core foundation for Christianity anyway. If we look at the Old Testament and its stories and its heroes, one has even less, if that's possible, evidence for the existence of the patriarchs than we have for Jesus and his disciples. The antiquity of the story doesn't make it true. There is much evidence to suggest that the biblical heroes of the Old Testament merely served a purpose in their own time for Hebrew tribal groups in that part of the world at that time. If there was indeed an empire, of David and of Solomon, one would have expected something left in the ground to demonstrate that fact. I mean, empires usually leave an enormous amount of evidence. Now, okay, the Jewish empire of David and Solomon wasn't the Roman Empire. It was not nearly as grand. But nonetheless, according to the Bible, Jerusalem was an imperial city full of its great structures, its meeting halls, its palaces.
Mm-hmm.
It is an extraordinary fact that we have not yet discovered one brick from the empire of David and Solomon. There is absolutely nothing to substantiate that this empire ever existed outside the pages of Holy Scripture. Now, it doesn't take a genius to work out that if the house of David is a fabrication, then how can we have somebody descended from the house of David coming down as a god and as a man, the savior of the Christians? If the fables that underpin the Jewish religion are false, then Christianity is itself false. Yes, it shouldn't surprise us that any people has heroic stories of origins. You know, that is common to peoples all over the world. But of course, we've moved on, and hopefully we've moved out of this mythological age. Of course, what makes this whole study necessary, besides being just sheer interest in its own right, is many people still cling to, or even are now resurrecting, these ancient ideas in a very dogmatic and fundamentalist way. And that's what makes it all the more urgent to make available, and in a digestible form, some home truths, you know, because this is the only defense against, you know, a terrible movement into a new age of blinkered vision and bigotry.
Well, yeah, a new age which would echo an old age, because you also detail on the website the kind of astonishing abuses to which this information was put dogmatically in the dark period of the Christian Church. I mean, they went nuts with this stuff, and boy, did they ram it down people's throats.
Absolutely. I mean, that is what it is like. It's so depressing and so sobering. The mind that has certainty of truth to the point of willingness to destroy others is a very frightening prospect. I'm happy for people to disagree with me. Nobody has to accept what I have to say, and I respect their right to hold contrary views. But unfortunately, through the course of centuries, any choice in your thoughts, and the word heretic means choice, any choice other than the official orthodox understanding that the church gave you, was liable to cause your execution in a most painful and horrifying way.
Let's take another brief break. You're on The Next Level on breakfornews.com. We'll be right back.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, oh, tell me, heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. Is it all that Peter is cold?
Stand up for
the ism, schism game, dine and go to heaven in a Jesus name, Lord. We know and we understand, Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light. What you gonna we gonna do? Stand up for our rights. Yeah, yeah, so you better get up.
As you go through this, and I'm sure there are many people listening right now who are experiencing a certain emotional response to what we're discussing, because as I say, it is so embedded in us from childhood, if you've grown up as I have in a Christian society. How did you handle that yourself? What was your religious background, and how did this information impact you as it became clear?
In a sense, probably I'm untypical of most people's experience, because I grew up in a very irreligious environment where, frankly, nobody in my circles, in my neighborhood, went to church. There was no. But however, oddly enough, I became very interested in religion. To me, it was a fascinating behavior pattern, so I've always been interested in it. But I suppose my breakthrough came at a very young age, when I remember staring ahead rather than at my shoes when asked to pray, and defying God to send a thunderbolt, you know. And it never happened, and I thought, well, he belongs along with the Father Christmas and the fairies. You know, so from a very young age, you know, I just did not accept this idea. So now, I'm untypical. I think what is more typical is from the, I can judge from some of the emails I receive from people who have really agonized through many years, as they tell me, in leaving their faith behind. And some of them even feel that to have, if you like, an incorrect thought, they might then be subject to some spiritual punishment or some haunting or some retribution. And, you know, all I can say is, well, it doesn't happen unless it happens in your own mind. It's probably small comfort. I can accept that for people who perhaps are nurtured and conditioned to think a certain way, such an emphatic statement that contradicts what they believe or they perhaps believe can be a jolt.
Yes.
But humankind has moved on through the millennia. There was a time when every Greek believed in the gods of Olympus. There was a time, in fact, thousands of years, when the peoples of Egypt believed in their gods of Isis and Osiris and so on. You know, well, we just laugh at such notions now. You know, if someone said they were afraid of retribution from Zeus, you know, it would just be a figure of fun. You know, well, Jesus eventually will take his place along with Zeus and Horus and the others as a god who had a certain following over a certain period of historical time, until people realized it was simply an elaborate mythology.
For people who have grown up in a Christian society, it does pose this problem that we all want to aspire to the best human behavior we can. And for many people, they anchor that in the figure of Jesus, if you know what I mean. They anchor that part of the human spirit in the figure of Jesus. And if that's not there, where do they anchor that? Do they need to anchor it? Is there, in fact, a what you would call Christ consciousness in humanity, independent of these mythological figures? What's your feeling about that?
Well, these are certainly very relevant questions. They're very good questions to reflect upon. I believe we have a core humanity. It's part of the condition of being a human. I don't believe we need from on high a code to compel us to be good. I think unless we're under stressful situations, we have a natural humanity, and that would show itself. And it's interesting that within all religions, one can see good people at work. So they are able within that religious structure to do good. Now, they would probably do good if they swapped that religion for another religion, mm-hmm. or indeed if they swapped it for no religion at all.
Yes.
Because, you know, that is coming from their humanity, not from their religion. Now, if people feel that the Bible is a good book, I suggest they read it, because probably no other book has been written so filled with genocide and murder,
right.
and horrible acts of humans towards each other, as
yeah.
well as the horrible acts of an intervening deity, that book is not a good book, it's a horrible book. Now, whether people, and we're speaking of people today who have been brought up in a Christian society, whether people in their own minds have constructed a pure Jesus, as far as they're concerned, who has all the best attributes, then fine, that is their way of structuring a role model. But it's not based upon any historical reality. It's coming from their own psychology. And maybe they need that. Not everybody perhaps can live without such a figure. All I have done is to try and outline the historical roots of a fabrication. If people wish to continue with the notion, and then some people do push the idea of, okay, it's all bunk, but there's a Christ within. Now, okay, I don't have a problem with that. If we feel that we have part of the cosmos within us, that it's part of the great pantheist universe, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. It's a separate issue. Yes, it does take a little bit of courage to move into a world where we don't have such certainties that we attribute to external agencies and call them God. Yes, that's called, you know, maturing, that's called growing up.
Have we indeed constructed these figures in our own image and likeness? If you take a look, for example, Ken, at the God of the Old Testament, as you point out, this is one bloodthirsty dude, and the sort of guy you wouldn't want to cross. Because if you cross this guy, he'll wipe you out and all your descendants, etc.
Yep.
That seems to me constructed out of human psychology. And so these negative attributes of the Jewish deity, they mirror negative attributes in humanity itself. In that context, it might be encouraging to see the Jesus figure is at least a more rounded God individual, shall we say, than the Old Testament guy was.
Yes, yes. I mean, I take your point. Certainly the first point is very valid. People have created gods in their own image, and many an observer and a writer has pointed that out, that people have actually created a Jesus in their own image, more to the point. You know, in a time of liberal humanitarianism, it was a liberal humanitarian Jesus. In times of the Crusades, it was a Crusader Jesus. In the hippie era, we had a hippie Jesus.
Yes.
I mean, Jesus becomes whatever we wish him to be. And if you like, that's in itself a proof of the fact that there's no real Jesus there at all. You know, and it's quite interesting that Jesus can be both the liberator and the figure of authority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's both the poor shepherd and the king in his glory. He's all things to all men, and you can emphasize whichever aspect you wish of this phantom.
You have been, I think, blessed with a background which gave you an innate skepticism and an inherent freedom from religious dogma. But nevertheless, you felt you had to challenge the deity structure. And for a lot of people, they're just... I found it myself, as someone who grew up in a Catholic culture, that it was scary, Ken, going outside of the norm.
It's interesting, this, because obviously I get quite a mailbox from believers of all denominations. Probably not more than 1% would ever challenge any of the evidence or information on my website. What they do say to me, you know, either I will burn in hell, or they feel sorry for me, or I must have been hurt by a Christian or something like that. They feel that I'm a lost soul. You know, they can't actually understand how one can be a rational human being, progress through life without believing in any of these fables, and yet take an intelligent person's interest in them. So, yeah, yes, for some of them, sure, this is this indignation that I might stand up to their Lord and Saviour, but of course they have to then grapple with the fact that, well, nothing seems to be happening, and the worst danger is, of course, comes from people like them who can't stand anybody criticising their point of view.
Well, your background has given you an ideal sceptical framework. Sometimes your very liberation from these ideas from an early age causes you to put things in almost a provocative way, but I found it very stimulating because it's just so many individual pieces of the puzzle you've put together, Ken, and you hammer us with every single one. And even as a sceptic, I came away reeling from your website.
That's great, because that's exactly how I designed it to be, and so you've confirmed I'm actually hitting the mark. I know that no believer will actually come away from my website not believing, but what they might is have the shadow of a doubt. And people who already have a shadow of a doubt will have an even bigger doubt. And people who are only just hanging on in there will actually then discard their faith entirely. I know that's how it will work.
The sheer volume of information which you've collected on the website, and how well laid out it is, means that you should go to JesusNeverExisted.com and check it out for yourself. And also, Ken, you are going to bring out a book, which I think a lot of people will appreciate as well, because they can get the information to those who are not on the internet. How is that coming on, the book version?
Many of the key essays from the website are available in a book. It should be available by the end of the month. And yes, it has the same title as the website, Jesus Never Existed, and details for ordering the book can be found on the website itself.
It's a challenging message, Ken. It's an extraordinary compilation of evidence, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure, and I've enjoyed your questions. Thank you.
Our thanks to Kenneth for that, and whatever you think about the evidence which is presented on JesusNeverExisted.com, it's certainly not to be dismissed lightly. That's it for this edition. I'll be back soon with more, and I do hope that you can join me for that. But in the meantime, forbreakfornews.com. This has been Fintan Dunn reporting.
Hope I never gotta survive.